Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by the new FX PhD Resolve 2012 Fast Forward course. Download 10 classes instantly covering DaVinci Resolve 9 and take your color grading skills to the next level. Visit fxphd.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today, we're going to have a deep technical chat with DNEG's Philippe Leprince, head of lighting and rendering at DNEG in London. He's also one of the founders of OpenSourceVFX.com. We're going to talk about the remake of the film Total Recall, as well as DNEG's new physically plausible shaders and changing their pipeline because of RenderMan version 16. It's an appropriately technical talk as we're here at SIGGRAPH 2012 in Los Angeles. Our coverage is well underway. We've got written articles and FX Guide TV episodes, the first of which is out as I record this, covering the new releases from Shotgun and ThinkBox software. Shotgun, of course, is the job management software that is in use in so many facilities around the world. They've announced Revolver and Tank, and we get the details directly from them. ThinkBox is behind Krakatoa and so many other tools, and we'll talk to Chris Bond and get the latest. That's over at FX Guide TV on the main site, fxguide.com. We're also very excited to announce a couple of new initiatives at FX Guide and FX PhD. First, we've released a free iBook. Many of you will already know about Moving Day, a short film directed by Jason Wingrove and written by Matt Graham, which tells the story of a young girl who moves with her family into a new manor, but ends up encountering some particularly feisty fairies. Moving Day was produced with the help of members of FX PhD, FX Guide's sister visual effects training site. And now, thanks to the readers of FX Guide, we're pleased to announce a free behind-the-scenes iBook on the making of Moving Day, available right now for download from iTunes. If you have an iPad, this is a great behind-the-scenes making-of piece and really showcases the power of the iBook format. Lots of behind-the-scenes and making-of videos, the script, storyboards, even the entire film. I think you'll enjoy this, and it's free. There's a written story about this at FX Guide that includes the iTunes download link. This iBook was made possible in part by the recent sponsorship drive we did as part of our FX Insider program. And the second announcement is for FX Inside members only. One of our goals of the sponsorship drive was to begin development of our FX Guide iPad application. We're happy to say that thanks to your support, we'll be opening a beta program for testing this application. The app is designed to be the perfect iPad viewing environment for FX Guide. We already spent a lot of time making the web experience as good as we can, and that's pretty good on the iPad, but we wanted to offer an even more advanced experience for iPad users. One of the things we're offering is an offline viewing mode, where you click a button and download the last week of content from the site. We're also looking to provide features like, let's say you wanted a copy of the Art of series we've been doing with you at all times for reference. We're also thinking of offering things like higher res retina quality imagery. Again, there's a story about all of this at fxguide.com, and there's info about how to sign up, this time only visible for FX Insider members. All right, well, let's jump now to our interview. Mike Seymour speaking with DNEG's Philippe Leprince.
So, Philippe, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Great work on the film. Just terrific.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The first impression I had about the visual effects coming out of the film was the digital environments. I just thought that they were some of the best we'd seen in a while, and I just couldn't get over both the scope of them and the complexity of them. And I was wondering if we could talk to you a bit about the rendering pipeline that can handle that level of complexity. And I understand it's a fairly new pipeline as far as DNEG's concerned.
Yes, absolutely. It's a new pipeline we developed about a year ago, a bit more, 18 months. So we had a really good pipeline called V3. And the last movie it was used on was John Carter of Mars. So it gave really nice looking results, but it was not physically plausible, and it was quite demanding in terms of how much work you had to put into, you know, tweaking things to make it look right. So we decided to move on to something physically plausible, and as we were still in a John Carter of Mars, we realized that we couldn't really put more physical plausibility in the V3 framework, and we had to really rewrite everything from scratch. So that was pretty much how V4 was born. And we collaborated with Simon Primoz to work out a new architecture.
So if we could walk through just the pipeline that got you to the shots that we love so much of both sides of the planet. And by the way, I kind of think it's ironic, but of course, being from Australia, I was very keen to be called a colony. And of course, we're coming from our ancestors, kind of. But don't worry, I'm not in any way upset about it. But yes, so if we can walk through the pipeline, for a start, a lot of those city assets, I understand, were being generated in terms of a data model out of City Engine. Is that right?
Yes. So City Engine was used to create variations of buildings, really, and. But it wasn't used to fully create the environment, as far as I know, because it was creating other problems. That's something we are trying to tackle at the moment on another movie we're working on. But at the time, it wasn't quite there. So the layout was still done slightly differently, yes.
So you have models coming from City Engine. You obviously have your own models, and there are a lot of hero models for the both sides of the planet. And
yes,
I'm curious, do you use Katana or something? Like, what's the model that's pulling these assets together? Because it's a very dense set of models to light in these big wide shots.
No, so we have our own asset system, and everything was done in Maya. We have our own random man exporter called Rex, and Rex has been used at DNEG since Bad Band Begins. It was developed for Bad Band Begins, and it's got a fairly solid asset management system, and we can really have lots and lots of buildings in Maya scene without running into too much trouble. But in the case of Total Recall, it was definitely pushing the envelope too much for Rex. So Katana is something we are looking into now, but we were not really in a hurry before that, simply because Rex would handle those scenes usually quite well.
So what is it? Is it Rags or just in Maya with Rags? I mean, a lighting TD when they're opening up a scene to work on a wide shot of the city of London or whatever, the United Federation of Britain. What is it that they're opening up at? And because that's like, would I assume, be incredibly hard to open up in Maya as without a lot of data management?
Yeah, absolutely. So when people load a Maya scene containing a city layout, typically they don't see the geometry itself. They just see the bounding boxes of the geometry. And they can selectively choose a couple of things and either load a representation of that to get a better perception of what they are framing or what they are trying to light. But most of the magic is happening at render time through our Rex DSO inside PR Man. The DSO loads all the geometry on demand, and that allows us to be able to get a lot of stuff on screen without having to load everything up front.
So is it the case that this move to the new pipeline coincided with RenderMan 16? I mean, this must have been in this film, you must have had to use a lot of ray tracing, and this move to plausible shaders and plausible lighting, you're obviously
yes.
Very tied to RenderMan.
Yeah, so when we received the first beta of PRMan 16, we had been working on the new framework for a couple of months at least, and there was this new Radio City cache. It was a single line in the release notes, and I was like, oh, looks interesting. So I took my usual test scene, and I rendered it with this new option. And at first, I thought that something had gone wrong because it was 50 times faster than what it used to be in 15. So I was like, oh, the timings must be wrong or something. And I redid it many times, and that was just a lot faster. So from that moment, we decided that we would try to do everything ray traced as much as possible.
So the move to plausible shading and plausible shading is not necessarily just a complete fait accompli, because in many senses you're moving to a system where everything is more normal in a sort of real world sense. But a lot of lighting people and a lot of visual effects work is done by doing all sorts of tricks and doing all sorts of manipulations, and you're often rendering in odd ways to do different things. I'm wondering, how much did it sort of philosophically change you to start moving over to plausible lighting and stuff and sort of dropping some of those tricks? Or do you find that you can, with the sort of hybrid nature of RenderMan, still maintain many of them?
Well, that's the crux of the problem. So when we started implementing everything, it was just consolidating a lot of ideas that we had been, exploring for a long time, because even the V3 framework had important sampling, but only BSDF sampling, not multiple important sampling. And we were really, familiar with all those concepts. But what we discovered as soon as we began to let people use our new framework was that it was very, very different for the artists. They were not, there are some things that were completely alien to them. For example, we made some really strict choices at the beginning to make sure that we wouldn't have to do crazy things under the hood in the shaders and be able to keep things grounded in reality as much as possible. For example, we decided that all the lights would have a natural fall-off. There is no fall-off computations in our shaders, actually, because light doesn't fall off with distance. It's just a hack that was invented because you didn't have area lights. And you didn't have normalized BSDFs in the old days. So all those things threw off a lot of our artists. And the main problem then is to try to teach them how to use those new tools and understand how they work, because it looks a lot more complicated at the surface, because we use a lot of terms like albedos and whatnot. But all those things are fairly simple. It's just that people are kind of afraid at the beginning of all the new terms.
Yeah, because in many respects, notwithstanding just terms and stuff, it is a conceptually simpler model because it's closer to real-world behavior and doesn't require the tricks. But that being said, it seems like many cases people are so used to being able to get such great results by various tricks they've developed for a long period of time that you just sort of have to rethink things. And also, as you pointed out, the move to area lights and I presume full energy conservation that goes with it and HDR mapping and stuff does change that role. Did you have like a transitional period, or did you just jump over in one film and say, there we go, we've moved over?
We jumped. It was a bit crazy, but it worked really well for The Dark Knight. For The Dark Knight, we were in really close contact with the leads, and basically they adopted our, every piece of advice we gave them, and ended up being able to achieve a lot in very little time. So they were, I think it was the first show that and it worked really brilliantly in that respect. But it was, you know, a very specific look because Chris Nolan wants things to be completely grounded in reality, and he's not the type of guy who's going to art direct the CG to say, oh, I want a rim here, a little kick there. You know, if it's not justified by the plate, basically there's no reason it should be there.
So on Total Recall, for example, if we move away from those big exteriors, the high sort of helicopter-type shots of the virtual cities, well, not the virtual, but, you know, in the, obviously they're not real cities, when you get down at a lower level and you're starting to deal with the synthetic cops and the cars and stuff, presumably also the pipeline was built well for incorporating set sampling and set HDRs and stuff. Can you talk about that, like stuff that people bring in from set and how that feeds the pipeline and how you use that in the lighting?
Yeah, so we use different things. We acquire HDRs on set, of course, using different techniques. We use Canon cameras, but we also have a Spheron, and we also have a LiDAR that we use sometimes to acquire the set geometry. We can use the Spheron to do the two takes trick and re-triangulate.
So let's discuss that for a second, because your camera rig, you have a multi-SLR camera rig that basically takes the HDRs without having to someone stand there and turn around and orientate it. That's like a complete packaged up rig.
Yeah, absolutely. The Snapper. So the Snapper is four cameras in a box, and you bring it somewhere. You step back, and there is a little laptop that will allow you to remote control it, and it will basically transmit all the images directly to the laptop over Wi-Fi, and you will be able to check your HDR quite quickly.
Okay, but
that's something we're still working on. It's still a bit slow, but it's a very promising way of doing things. It's quite, you know, efficient, and that's. So far, it's been like the best, the most reliable, acquire the maximum dynamic range in the HDRs.
But as I understand it, that multi-SLR rig, just because of the physical nature of the construction, when you have, you can have the same nodal point for orientating the cameras, but you can't obviously put all the lenses at exactly the same place in physical space. So that would work best for things that aren't close to camera, where you're not worried about any kind of parallax. Like, I mean, for example, a sky dome for an exterior car shot, it's going to work really well, but you probably wouldn't work so well in a kitchen set. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. But we also, the merging of the of all the HDRs is done by our own software, and we compensate to an extent to you know, make it a bit more accurate,
right,
in a sense.
But if you wanted to do, for example, a set where you're going to put the synthetic robots coming in and there's a lot of close interaction and stuff, is that where you'd switch to using the Spheron and do the offset to get the parallax scan distance data?
No, I don't think we used much the Spheron on Total Recall.
Okay.
The Spheron gives really great results, but it's very, very slow.
Right.
And most of the time on set, it's really difficult to get even 3 minutes to acquire an HDR. So it's not always practical.
And then you were saying LiDAR. So that's obviously very dense point clouds. I can imagine, obviously, the LiDAR feeding into helping to work out sets and, you know, producing a really good stand-in geometry. But is it a combination of that also lets you, because I presume that you're extracting lights from the HDR from a sphere so that you actually have them as on quads or something in the scene, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. But, it really depends on what type of set you've got, because, for example, in Total Recall, there were sets where we had elevator shafts or things like that. And so, you know, just using an HDR wasn't really practical in the sense that your illumination is supposed to be at infinity on an HDR. And when you start localizing your lights, then if the characters are moving around or the camera is moving, you end up rebuilding the whole set and replacing all the light sources in the set. So that's really something we had to work on, the performance of our integration, to make sure that we would be able to handle a very, very large number of lights in our 3D sets. That's actually something that we're going to present as a stupid random hand trick at the Renderman user group tonight. So.
Oh, really? Well, insofar as by the time people listen to that, you will have presented it. What does that involve? What does that involve?
So, the stupid trick, well, the stupid part is that we implemented a ray tracer in PRMan. So that sounds like a bit too much work, but yeah. For multiple important sampling, you need to first light sample and then BSDF sample. And when you BSDF sample, you create a number of directions that are contained inside the lobe of your BSDF. And then you need to intersect those directions with the lights on set. So what happens is, at the beginning when we were testing our system, we were using maybe 5-10 lights, and the performance was fine. And then some people on TR told us, well, you know, it looks great, but it's very slow. And we started looking at scenes, and we saw that they had between 400 and 5,000 lights in their scene. So, of course, things were not scaling so well. So, basically, what we ended up doing is implement as a DSO a basic ray tracer that would allow us to test every direction against all area lights at once. And that would limit radically the number of tests that needed to be done, and give us a lot of flexibility, because people wouldn't be so concerned anymore about adding more lights to the set. They would just keep adding lights. So at the end, it went a bit crazy, because I think 5,000 lights is a bit. Yeah, over the top, but in some really wide scenes at night where you have all the street lights and everything, well, I guess it makes sense anyway, so we have to deal with that.
Well, certainly in the colonies, you had a lot of wet surfaces and a lot of neon lights and stuff, and so I can imagine you could start to really, you know, get quite a lot of lights, especially in those broader set extensions, but not the sort of super high shots.
Yeah.
And just for people that are listening, that doesn't sound like a stupid idea, but of course you're referring to the RenderMan stupid rat tricks, which is where at the user group people present ideas. So I just, if people didn't understand, you weren't actually calling your idea stupid. That's just what they called at the user group meeting. In terms of getting this to the farm and just sort of managing the process of rendering these really big shots, the move to doing all this stuff and all this ray tracing, did it present any problems? I mean, you said it ran a heck of a lot faster when you were trying it at test phase, but in practice, what was the sort of comparative render performances you were getting on these projects?
Well, it's much slower than the previous framework. But the previous framework was really relying on a lot of baking. We're using a lot of point clouds to do global illumination. We're using ray tracing only for shadowing on direct lighting. So now everything is ray traced, including indirect. We still allow people to do point-based indirect diffuse if they want to. Before we would, company-wide, we would limit the render time of any single frame to 2 hours. Of course, we had to review those limits since we introduced V4. So it's more around 4 hours. So four hours is per frame at 2K is okay. We had some render times that were much, 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 much longer than that, especially in the very large vistas. Sometimes it would take a really long time.
So in terms of your work, it's pretty much a lot of it's just hard surfaces and stuff. I mean, there weren't any considerations for subsurface scattering type stuff, was there? Or was there? I mean, I assume it was all...
Yes, we have integrated ray-traced subsurface scattering in our framework. It was used on Snow White, actually. The tree creature that you can see just for a moment at some point during the nightmare sequence, I think, in the forest. There is a shot where she looks at the tree and there's this creature unfolding with winged wings, and the wings are scattering and the body of the creature is scattering as well. It's all been done using subsurface scattering. It was really quick to render.
So what model are you using for subsurface scattering on that? Is that a multi-dipole or...?
This one is just the dipole from Jensen.
And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about kind of philosophically is some companies, in terms of their lighting pipeline, especially now they're... and this is not necessarily, you know, in RenderMan, so it may not be a direct comparison, but there seems to be some interesting work done with how you pass on to the compositing team their view of being able to alter lighting. So clearly, no matter what renderer you use, you could do a normal pass, and there are lots of different other passes that you could do. But there seems to be some interesting stuff happening with trying to actually pass specific lights out to the compositors, so they're actually able to more isolate a light. And within a light, of course, it's spec component. But therefore, you know, as we've moved to this more physically based lighting, at the rendering stage, you can also sort of literally have a control of, say, the key light or the backlight. Are you looking at this in any particular way? I mean, this is basically AOVs coming out of Arnold in the case of Sony, but in case of your pipeline, are you doing that?
Well, we are... One of the things that we realized at the beginning of our work on the framework is that if you want to do things correctly, sometimes it's not possible to recompose the beauty in comp.
Yeah.
Because a lot of stuff becomes view dependent, and because of Fresnel terms, for example, or simply because you have a layered BSDF model where the rays are entering, being in the first layer, they are refracted, they hit the second layer, they are then bouncing back and be refracted out. So, for example, you cannot possibly relight those things in comp. It's impossible because you would have to model the light transport inside the top layer. And there's a number of... When we started profiling V4, we found that if we start doing all the crazy bookkeeping that we need to do to be able to output a lot of AOVs, it slows down our performance quite significantly. So we had to strike a balance between outputting enough stuff for comp so that they still have enough leeway after the fact, but not killing ourselves by trying to output, you know, every direct and indirect component separately.
So what sort of flexibility is provided to the comp team? Because you said, I think, that you went to Newkirns, the end... because obviously back on the earlier Batman films, for example, you were doing Shake or your own version of Shake.
Yes. So we output, we can output the same way we did before. We can output all the lights per light groups. So you can have up to 5 light groups in our framework, and you can have more than 1 light per light group, of course. So it's up to you to really organize your lights, and then you will get separate components for, you know, direct diffuse, indirect diffuse, direct specular, direct glossy, indirect glossy, versions that are shadowed and unshadowed, and plus a lot of mats and technical AOVs like P-World, N-World, PRF, whatever. There's a whole list of them. So all in all, we render a lot of things. I think the one thing that was a bit annoying at the beginning for the compositors, but they, you know, it was the lack of an occlusion pass. because they were so used to that tool to, you know, basically fix little problems or isolate sections of, you know, an image.
Yep.
That it was definitely a bit of a loss for them. But they adjusted really quickly to the new way. And they, you know, even though there are some things that we are not doing quite right at the moment, especially when it comes to extracting shadows, because there are some scenarios in which it's a bit difficult with global illumination. But still, I think they were reasonably happy with the output. But, you know, it's ongoing work. It's never really finished.
So, look, we, just in sort of finishing, we mentioned obviously the huge infrastructure with Maya and at the other end, Nuke, but also I think you used Mari for the texturing on this, didn't you? And obviously a lot of Houdini on the...
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to ask you, how long have you been using Mari and how have you found it?
Mari is great. I think it was really high time we had something that was able to get us rid of Photoshop. We are not quite at the point where we got rid of Photoshop, but we are getting extremely close now. I think the new versions of Mari are going to basically eradicate Photoshop from DNEG.
And I think the other thing is, it's not as if, just to clarify that, it's not as if Mari is replacing Photoshop because it just does photo manipulation better or something. It's that Mari tends to be like more of a complete solution to the problem of texturing as opposed to Photoshop, which seems to be more like a component in the problem of solving. Does that make sense? Like, it seems to me that Mari is like more comprehensive solution.
But the problem is that at the beginning, all you had was like Photoshop, and Photoshop was the single package everybody knew, you know. So whether you liked it or not, you had to deal with Photoshop. And we used other softwares like BodyPaint, and BodyPaint is quite good, but has stagnated a little bit. And Mari is a really very dynamic package, and the developers are really listening to our requests, and I think it's really a great improvement in our texturing workflow.
And certainly the whole PTEX solution seems to take away a world of pain from the UV pipeline before.
Yes, it's funny you mentioned PTEX, because that's something I'm really keen on pushing forward, and I used it on Inception. I was supervising on Inception, so I made sure we used PTEX. But since then, we didn't have a lot of usage for PTEX because, again, people are a bit worried that they will bake their texture into PTEX and then the topology will change and there is no good easy solution to basically rebake a PTEX or convert it to a new topology. So that's the annoying part. But
that's interesting you say that, because I thought there were... So what we're discussing here is that, like, I've got a model and I've PTEXed it, and obviously it's solving my mapping for me, but it's based on a relationship with the model that if I fundamentally change the model, it sort of goes hell in a handbasket. But I thought there actually were conversion tools that if you change the underlying topology would convert over, but you don't find those to be any good, or?
Well, last time I checked, there wasn't anything
satisfactory, right?
Yeah, so maybe things have changed. You know, I maybe didn't pay enough attention to that.
No, I'm sure you did.
It's quite possible.
You're the you know far more about it than I did. No, I was just curious because that's what I'd heard, and obviously you're using it in the real world, so it's good to know. And
then the thing is, basically on Inception, because we're baking our textures to point clouds and then turning them into PTEX, it was kind of easy to modify the topology of something and then rebake the point cloud and get a new PTEX. But what happens when you are in Mari and you say, okay, I'm going to use PTEX to texture this model, then basically your model changes and your work is kind of gone, you know?
Yeah, because it's mapping specifically to the underlying topology of the model to save you having to worry about doing it explicitly.
Absolutely.
But the other one I wanted to just touch on really quickly is Houdini, because Houdini seems to really come into its own and is sort of such a key part of atmospherics. And I assume that's what you were using it for a lot of volumetrics and atmospherics and effects animation?
We use it for simulation.
Right.
And but we have our own volumetric renderer called DNB.
Okay.
And we are exploring volumetric rendering in PRMan at the moment. The thing is, DNB is super fast, can handle gigantic volumes, super complex, and really there's not much competition out there. So we looked at what Houdini does, and it's great, but we would be more interested, I guess, in the long term in having a fully integrated solution, because once you start looking at light transport globally, you want your effects to interact with global illumination. You know, you want your smoke to cast shadow. You want multiple scattering in your smoke. You want indirect diffuse in your smoke. All that stuff makes sense. So that's what we're working on at the moment.
Yeah, in fact, if you don't have all that self-shadowing in the and as you say, shadowing through it, it tends to look very flat, which I guess brings me to another point that has been here at IMET SIGGRAPH a big discussion point, which is the OpenEXR2 and the deep image compositing work that happens. Nuke obviously supports deep image compositing. What's your position on deep image compositing?
Well, we love the idea. We hate the storage usage.
Well, yes, it is a lot of data.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that it's obviously very flexible, but then you know your comping also becomes extremely slow, because it's a lot more work than just an over.
Let me just be devil's advocate. So the theory would be that yes, the comping is slower because the data you have to carry forward explaining what the depth is much more complicated than before. But the theory would be that you would have gained that back because if you move something or change something, you don't have to adjust holdout mats and re-render, and putting together very complex scenes becomes more automatic because things have a correct kind of depth to transmissive or atmospherics kind of relationship. Is that something you would not agree with?
No, I totally agree. It's just that in our case, DNB being really fast at rendering volumetrics, you know, recomputing the volumes and outputting at the same time a deep shadow map that will be a deep holdout for the PRMan render wasn't so much of a problem. That wasn't our main bottleneck. The main bottleneck potentially is to re-render the PRMan scene. We did some tests with deep compositing, and we are planning on using it sparingly in when it's really worth it. I'm really hoping that the compression is going to improve so that we can use that in a more general way. Because obviously, yes, I'd love to get rid of all the, even, you know, there's a lot of things in compositing that are still slightly wrong if you're not careful, because you don't have the subsamples really. What you have is just the final accumulation over the area of 1 pixel. So deep compositing in that regard is more flexible and also more accurate.
So as I understand it from what has been announced with OpenEXR2 and the work from various companies like Weta and Pixar and people contributing, and ILM of course, if you're running OpenEXR2, there's absolutely no reason why it needs to be any more overhead unless you're using the deep compositing, because you can just obviously access the files and you have to take the data hit of carrying it forward. But other than that, but it does seem like the OpenEXR sort of format, which is everything this side of a tar file with one sort of proviso that it all has the same sort of colorimetry and it has to have the same time code or key code. But it does seem like a great container for doing the kind of work that you're doing. Do you embrace the sort of advances with OpenEXR2 in sort of general terms, or?
Absolutely, I love it, and I think it's going to be great. We tried to package, for example, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, a bit before Iron Man 2. We tried to package all our AOVs into a single DXR file. And then we discovered that the comping performance was going down the drain super fast. And it's just because of the data layout in the XR files when you have multiple channels. And OpenEXR2 gives an alternate data layout, which means that we won't have this bottleneck anymore. And it will help, you know, compositing immensely. And if only for that, I welcome OpenEXR 2.0.
And the other open source initiative that's had a rapid adoption, probably even more rapid than OpenEXR did in the early days, has been Alembic. Have you gone that way with your pipeline?
Not yet, no. For the time being, we are using our own internal format called Xen, which has been used for quite a few years. So by the time Alembic appeared, we were already using Xen everywhere, pretty much. So Alembic does a few things better than Xen, but it's a big pipeline, and it's a difficult decision.
Well, just to take us back to where we started, I just think the environments and the renderings work that your team and you have done in this film is astonishingly good. I mean, there are shots in this that I really just wanted to take a still frame of and stick up on the wall. And I'm talking about a film that is not been working in sort of the render sizes that even Dark Knight was. And, of course, Dark Knight, again, same thing, except for at even higher resolutions because of the IMAX component. So clearly you've got your pipeline working very, very well, and it's astonishing to see the kind of leaps and bounds that you guys are doing. But congratulations, and it's just terrific. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much. It was, you know, a lot of people really spent a long time on that movie, and they deserve all the congratulations rather than me.
Well, that's true, but being able to get this kind of volume of material through your facility and so accurately, and it's a non-trivial problem. I mean, we sometimes jump over some of these steps and say, yeah, and then we rendered it, but getting these things to the point that you can even render them is a really complicated problem. So thanks again.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks to Mike and to Philippe. As I mentioned at the beginning, we really appreciate our FX Insiders. FX Insider members help support the site through their contributions. As a thanks for donations, as being part of the FX Insider program, we give you access to additional exclusive content, like member-only articles, additional effects breakdowns, and more. And as I mentioned, a new iPad app beta. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. In addition to the FX podcast you've been listening to, we do two other regular audio podcasts. The first is the VFX Show, which reviews visual effects in current releases as well as classic films. The RC podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd also recommend our HD video podcast, FX Guide TV. Also, check out our sister site, fxphd.com, offering extensive online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.